GPW News. I'm DJ Sesti. This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Sesti, on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week, short little update on Candace King's rent strike. They've established a co-op there of people that, when they get a land trust, they will have tenants to populate that land trust. So they've done that and are talking about a tenants union, which is what we need here, as well as a homeless union here in every city. And so progress on that. And then I threw in YouTube video on Billionaire's Row, which is a bunch of skyscrapers in New York that sit empty for tax purposes. I remember this story back at least in the 90s, if not the 80s, that they had built these buildings and couldn't rent them out. But it turns out that they were just a tax haven the whole time, that's why. And so they built totally unnecessary buildings instead of building low-cost housing for the homeless. They just built buildings for the wealthy to park their money, instead of taking a risk with that money and investing in alternative technology that we need so desperately right now, like hemp building materials and rooftop solar. So that's what the show is going to be about for the next few weeks, is where the money goes. Follow the money, as Jim Garrison and Oliver Stone say, follow the money. What you'll find is the capitalists don't follow their own rules, whether you believe in capitalism or not. They don't follow their own rules, and they subsidize multinational corporations instead of new technology, like theoretically a capitalist should. But we all know that that doesn't seem to work. So the solution is, at least that I'm advocating, is co-ops and co-op. Looking at a land trust myself for my property, which would be a co-op of people that are interested, that have an interest in the property, and have an interest in making the property work properly for everyone. And that's what we can also do. We can do that with the forest, too. We have a co-op of that is made up of the community that the forest affects. So, in other words, water, the whole watershed, the forest affects the whole watershed, so the forest would in effect be owned by the residents of that watershed, and it would work within a cycle of that watershed. Which reminds me, I'm calling for a demonstrating in front of Home Depot's. Home Depot's use Weyerhaeuser lumber, which advocates clear cutting, and as a sustainable practice. Their labor practices at Home Depot, constantly being accused by employees of union busting, and they allegedly have been funding the Atlanta Police Foundation with the Home Depot Foundation. So for these reasons, they've just not been a very good citizen of the United States, and I think their corporate charter should be revoked, because they've just done more damage to the community than they have good. And let's replace Home Depot with a transitional housing for the homeless. Maybe divide it into four sections and make four little mansions inside of a Home Depot, even if you had to. But at least get some transitional housing. We don't want to warehouse the homeless, but some viable, well-maintained transitional housing. All right, thanks for listening. Up next, update on Candace King's rent strike here in Eugene, coming to a town near you. And yeah, Billionaires Row. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Rent strikers allege that R&R Properties sent letters to Almaden street tenants threatening eviction proceedings, quote, if they did not remove the protesters from the collective driveway. From the Springfield Eugene Tenant Association and Eugene Housing and Neighborhood Defense and staff reports, with Eugene experienced a surge in renter evictions, a local nonprofit announced that its renter hotline would temporarily close, and one of the eviction cases launched an organized rent strike. The Springfield Eugene Tenant Association, or SETA, said it hopes to restore full service to its renter hotline as quickly as possible. Callers to the renter hotline, 541-972-3715, hear a recorded message that states, quote, we are not able to respond back to any calls at this time. Due to a large influx of calls and our hotline being understaffed, we've made the difficult decision to temporarily close our hotline, SETA Executive Director Tim Morris said in a media release. This is not a decision we make lightly or without serious consideration, he said, but the hotline has been very understaffed for a little over a month, and the temporary closure will allow current personnel to catch up to the huge amount of calls we've received recently. It is clear to us that attempting to operate our hotline as if we were at full capacity has been harmful to the health and well-being of our staff, which we take very seriously, Tim said. SETA directed clients with questions about renter rights or renter assistance to its online resources guides and to the White Bird Little Help book. Renters currently being evicted or seeking renter assistance are directed to call 211. Because the hotline has paused operations, SETA may not be able to provide complete eviction data for August. The importance of that data was highlighted during the July 24th Eugene City Council meeting. Eugene City Councilor Mike Clark, a mortgage specialist in the local housing market, predicted that evictions would spike during the 30 days after passage of the renter protection package, right up until it becomes law. He said he has been discussing the options facing property owners and investors with his clients and colleagues to pencil out the new renter relocation assistance. He said many landlords plan to evict their current tenants. This would give them the option to choose tenants under the new rules, convert the property to a short-term rental, or sell the property. Councilor Clark also suggested that because SETA had advocated for the renter protection measures, the nonprofit should not also be providing the data used to evaluate those measures. In response to Councilor Clark, Tim Morris replied by email, SETA resolved, on average, 170 cases per month with tenants in the Lane County area. Our data is published by our hotline team that, by requirement, does not engage in advocacy on SETA's behalf. Furthermore, we report our data on what renters are facing every day to the whole of the state of Oregon, including the city of Eugene. Eugene's own staff has reported that one-third of renters living in our city are severely rent-burdened, and the vacancy rate is so low that it is a direct and expedient cause of our homelessness crisis. From our perspective, only one person here is acting partisan to paint a narrative that is not a part of Eugene's stark reality. We continue to be a part of the solution to homelessness prevention and are committed to working with our partners across the state to keep tenants safe, stable, and housed. The city contracted with SETA to operate the hotline and provide regular reports. With the hotline closed for now, it was not clear how city staff would obtain data about local tenant issues. Eviction data will be needed as part of a qualitative and quantitative analysis of impacts to renters, landlords, and the rental housing market. One of the many recent evictions has launched a Eugene rent strike. Supporters organizing on behalf of Candace King and family held a rally at 2 p.m. this Friday, August 11th, near the offices of the local family-owned property management company R&R Properties. The rent strikers demonstrated inside the office of R&R Properties last Friday, August 4th, quote, to bring awareness to their aggressive harassment campaign of their own tenants in the wake of the Candace King family rent strike and eviction. The protesters alleged that R&R Properties sent letters to their paying tenants threatening to start eviction proceedings August 1st if they did not remove the protesters from the collective driveway. Eugene Rent Strike alleges that tenants were warned they will be violating the guest policy of their leases if protesters are on the property. After receiving the letters, one house of tenants chose to leave and another chose to stay and fight, but both houses experienced chaos and fear at the hands of R&R Properties, the rent strikers said. An unnamed tenant is quoted, we were dragged into this just because we live in the same space, not because we actually violated our lease or did anything wrong. R&R is willing to make us homeless to try and make this problem go away, but we refuse to let them bully us out of our community. Candace King, whose eviction launched the local rent strike, repeated her offer to purchase the homes from the new owner. Candace King, whose eviction launched the local rent strike, repeated her offer to purchase the home from the owner. "We have a vision for these homes," she said, "that they are owned by the people who live in them and held in a community land trust that will care for the structures and the people in them for many decades to come. We will pursue this vision relentlessly. This is what our neighborhood needs and what everyone wants." The rent strikers and property managers have been asked to provide a copy of the letter for sharing in the searchable online archive of local government documents.
"Continue to show up and protest. We will work tirelessly to defend our neighborhoods and gain popular support until we accomplish our goal. Sincerely, the Almeida Tenants Union." I want to hear one big round of applause for the new Almeida Tenant Union.
Yeah!
Solidarity, more than like sympathy or just a sign in a window. It's real solidarity, connecting our struggles, uniting them, and taking on the responsibilities and risks that come with engaging in struggles. We can show solidarity in many ways, but this is very, very important, that we make meaningful change in our lives and for our community. This has radicalized me, this has radicalized a lot of people, and I appreciate you all for being here.
Yo!
Yo!
Thank you! Yeah.
Shout out to all of the comrades, not second of all, equally
Possum Kingdom, y'all. What a beautiful place for solidarity. That is our kingdom. We built it. There is no monarchy. We rule. It's proof. There's an old Adinkra saying, which is West African, that if you climb a good tree, you get a push. And for me, like, this is proof of that. Because we've been getting pushed up this tree since day one by y'all, by the community, by Tank. Thank you, Tank, for holding it down. I hope they get Bob on video today. How long can you live without rent? Forever! Okay. And also, the comrades down in Phoenix. Is it Phoenix?
No, it's in Scottsdale.
The bougiest town in Arizona. Shout out to the comrades in Scottsdale for, first of all, living in the belly of the beast, and second of all, for helping challenge this property management company and helping us in this struggle, showing them that we will not be intimidated, we will not be bullied away from this, and also, we're just gonna grow stronger and larger. All right, y'all, 52 days since June 21st. So that's since I was ordered to leave my home of 6 years, my children's home. Since the cruel indignity of the laws of this land of the free were declared okay to be played out against me and my children and extended family. What the powers that be didn't expect, and I bet still don't believe, is how laws become weak words in the face of solidarity. Real solidarity. In this timeline of despair, the inevitable terminal trajectory of discontent and rebellion are familiar fruits, dripping pungent dissonance from the branches of what was always a fucking poison tree. America. Hand says, dare to struggle, dare to win. And I think that's a beautiful sentiment. Right? To encourage folks to climb out of the sad predicament we're in. But where is the dare when you're exploited to be able to be exploited just to be for being compelled by nature to survive? In our timeline, under the din of the death rattles of the capitalist system, where is the dare when that layer of exploitation pushes us to compete with other shipmates for the good, grateful prize of the right to make monthly payments to de facto ratify the ongoing legacy of petulant genocidal theft of land, enslavement, exclusion, pervasive, protracted, racist, sexist, and classist and ableist manifest plundering colonialism. And those who benefit are perfectly satisfied to collect the royalties from all that shameful business. Generation after generation, while their position in the power dynamic makes them passive participants in perpetuating palatable acts of violence on the progeny of underrepresented, uncompensated people who suffered to build this sick nation, ya basta. Enough is enough. We were never idle, but we, the residents, neighbors, and broader community of 8th and Almaden, the now Almaden Tenants Union, are driven and focused and joined in solidarity as a union. And our labors are focused on a way out of this mess we're drowning in. I can read my handwriting. We understand that our situation could be worse, but why should it not be better? We are like anyone else in that we want to a life and a living that isn't just decent and safe. We know the only way to get that when we're under the thumb of the past is to reach back and get it and show how weak it is while looking forward to give it. When we win, we will build dual power and light a path for our comrades, which is anyone reconciled to the fact that we're expected to sell ourselves short for survival. put the ownership class on notice. This is more than just a blip, because even a ripple becomes a wave eventually. Today, we decided we aren't chattel on Sharon's retirement plantation anymore. We are the stones that the builder refused. Woo!
Property manglers is what we call them, work to maintain the bare minimum standard of housing in the area that they exist in. They do that in order to maximize profits for their clients and for themselves. And that can never be in the interest of tenants.
All right, so do these, is the whole model of renting, can you afford the upkeep and to keep a house in good shape and everything and still charge rent and still make money for your retirement?
You absolutely can if you inherit all that and you're prudent with your money, especially if you're retiring from actual work. You know, but Sharon has had the benefit of getting wealth, you know, either passed through to her from the ownership, her family's ownership of these properties since she was born. So at what point do we stop paying her for the legacy, her familial legacy of colonialism? I'm not blaming her for colonialism. I'm just blaming her for feeling like she's entitled to keep reaping the fucking benefits from it. Like, anybody with morals knows better that that was a bad game, you know? Right. When my family was on the Trail of Tears, we weren't happy about it.
But even a small family trying to rent out their house for retirement, the numbers just don't add up.
It's no, look, okay, so that's not real. That's not real. So I'm not gonna say there's good landlords out there, because I think the whole scheme is kind of stupid, but I think there's well-intended people out there who want to provide decent, nice, even affordable housing for people who need to rent because they don't have the credit or the down payment, or maybe they're not situated in a place they want to stay. But the problem is, when we get to a next level, like when you're actually present in the place where your properties are and your tenants live, then you have to look at it. Then you have to, internalize also the shame of if it's not looking right or if it's not habitable really at a decent level, because habitability is not the same as livability. Like, they're two different things.
All right, so last question, what is the Almaden Tenants Association? What is the organization you guys started?
We're a co-op, we're a limited equity co-op. Forming right now, we're raising money. We have raised a significant sum, and we will continue to raise money to purchase that property, even though we want her to give it to us, because, well, she should have savings, but she don't. And she's not getting any rent right now, so it's really uncomfortable for her to continue owning it. So we feel like we'll get a good deal. Either way, we're gonna buy that property and we're gonna take all the wasted ambient space there that's not good for anything, not good for gardening because of walnut trees, not good for playgrounds because of gravel, and we're gonna put units on it. It's gonna be intergenerational community with families who are working class families who need housing stability, because if you put kids in a situation where they grow up and they are stable and they don't have to worry about where they're gonna live and they don't have to face down this like scary, you know, the scary situation we have where the housing crisis, we call it landlord crisis, is making people homeless and uprooting them left and right all the time just because they can't pay rent and increasing rents when their wages aren't increasing at the same rate. We're going to put those kids into stable housing and see what kind of resilient, awesome community members they can become. Because I'll tell you what, it's going to save the state of Oregon a lot of money, so y'all should give us some money too.
Well, and so is there a tenant union going to be come out of this?
The tenant union is already formed. Now we're in the co-op stage. We are a cooperative. That is for the purpose of owning that land so that we can do something better with it than like sit around and be Sharon's plantation for retirement.
Right, anything else?
Yeah, make America Turtle Island again. Keep solidarity, y'all.
What about
Possum Kingdom will win.
EPW News, I'm DJ Susti.
This is Billionaire's Row. You've probably seen these buildings on social media. They're a stretch of homes in New York City that only the world's richest people can afford to live in.
Billionaire's Row here in New York City set off a super slender skyscraper revolution. Today, those towers are an astounding display of wealth, prestige, and engineering firsts. But they're also kind of empty. Back on the ground, finding an apartment for us non-billionaires is, well, take it from a New Yorker.
New York City housing is a scam. It is a scam, 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 scam. Woo!
3 years ago this very week, we released a video called The Rise and Rise of New York's Billionaire's Row. But now we want to look at its legacy. How did it come about? Why are so many of those apartments still sitting empty? And what does all that mean for the world of wealth and construction and the city itself?
Midtown Manhattan. It is here that one of the first skyscrapers was built.
New York is about building the tallest building and then coming back and building a taller building.
There is only one Billionaire's Row in the world, and it's in New York City, and it's on 57th Street, and it's all for profit.
Beverly Hills has its mega mansions, but when it comes to sheer stratospheric cost, New York City really may have them beat.
Oversupply in the sky. You actually look down on the Empire State Building.
Worth it. It is a safety deposit in the sky for some of the richest people in the world.
Some of the buildings on Billionaire's Row are quite beautiful and amazing constructs, but we're at a moment in society where there's a widespread great reckoning with the abuses of power and the concentrations of wealth.
We are the magnificent! We are the magnificent!
Just south of Central Park sit some of the most exclusive homes anywhere in the world. There are no official gates to Billionaire's Row, but the name refers to a handful of buildings on and around West 57th Street. Nestled alongside iconic New York landmarks like Carnegie Hall, the Russian Tea Room, and the Plaza Hotel, you'll also find 432 Park Avenue, 53 W53, 111 W57, 157, and Central Park Tower. A little further out, you have 220 Central Park South, 520 Park Avenue, and 252 East 57th Street. Now, it wouldn't be a B1M video if we didn't look at the engineering of these incredible, mind-bendingly slender towers. Skyscrapers have been getting progressively taller and thinner for years, but Billionaire's Row has given rise to a whole new breed of skyscraper entirely. The super slender residential tower. In Manhattan, space comes at a premium, which means if you want to build big, you've got to build up. To develop the small sites they'd secured with buildings tall enough to offer Central Park views, developers on Billionaire's Row spent years acquiring the air rights for the properties around their lots. That meant they could combine those new air rights to build their property taller and ensure those nearby buildings couldn't block their newly built views of Central Park. It's kind of like piecing together a very expensive puzzle. New York's building code considers a building slender if it has a width-to-height ratio of 1 to 7, but the towers over on Billionaire's Row go far beyond that. 157 was the first of the bunch to complete in 2014 with a ratio of 1 to 8. Then came 432 Park Avenue with a ratio of 1 to 15. From there, 53 West 53rd, 111 West 57th Street, and Central Park Tower all joined the ranks of super slender skyscrapers on Manhattan's skyline. Today, the thinnest of the bunch is 111 West 57th Street. The 85-story building is officially the world's thinnest skyscraper. It's just 18 metres wide, but rises to 435 metres in height. That's a width-to-height ratio of 1 to 24. Put it next to the Empire State Building or One World Trade Center, and you start to get an idea of just how astoundingly thin these new super slender buildings really are. But building so slender comes with its own unique structural challenges. Stiffening the structure is the key to maintaining stability. The materials have to be strong enough to keep the building steady, and concrete is often used to construct the core of the building. And of course, when you're 400 metres in the air, you have to think about the wind. To keep the building from swaying too much, 111 West 57th Street has an 800-ton tuned mass damper or giant swinging weight at the top, which works almost like a shock absorber in a car. Skyscrapers are always going to move a bit in the wind, but the goal is to reduce the sway enough so residents don't notice. Central Park Tower and 53 W53 both have setbacks that help to break up strong air currents and reduce the overall wind load acting on the building. And over at 432 Park Avenue, engineers left out the glass on the mechanical floors to let the wind flow through the structure. Of course, we do have to acknowledge some of the issues that have cropped up now that construction's finished. Residents of 432 Park Avenue sued the developers for a series of construction issues, including flooding, power outages, faulty elevators, and a noise caused by the building swaying in the wind. We reached out to CIM Group for comment on this lawsuit, but no one's come back to us. Now, there's a logic to the super slender tower. The taller you build, the more value you can squeeze out of that small plot of land that you were able to find on Manhattan Island. But these towers have even fewer units than similar buildings. Just take 111 West 57th Street. It has 60 units across 85 stories. Now, compare that to the Trump World Tower, built 20 years earlier, and you'll see that has 376 units over 90 stories. To make the construction of a super slender tower worth it, you have to make those units really, really, really expensive. And that's where realtors like Ryan Serhant come in. I caught up with Ryan at the offices of Serhant, his luxury real estate firm based here in Manhattan.
Take me into the world of Billionaire's Row. What's it like and how is it different to other luxury real estate elsewhere in Manhattan?
57th Street, Billionaire's Row, is a pretty global demographic. So there's a lot of pied-à-terre, so part-time owners, there's a lot of investor owners. You know, we're selling the penthouse right now, 432 Park, for $169 million US. The owner's never been there. And it's an investment, you know, it's an asset. It's like owning, you know, a Picasso. New York City had status symbol projects prior to Billionaire's Row, but never like it does now. Before, you'd say, hey, where do you live? 41 East 66th Street. You'd say, cool, where is that? Now you can say, where do you live? 432? Ah, it's a brand, right? It's like a Birkin bag. Where do you live? 157? Where do you live? 111? Where do you live? 220? You don't even have to say where it is, you just say the number.
Just behind me over there are the massive cast iron testicles of the Wall Street Bull. Now, they represent money, and of course, none of this would be possible without money. Loads and loads and loads of money. So much money, in fact, that it's actually helping transform housing from its most basic function of providing shelter into a lucrative investment strategy.
Now, to be clear, home ownership's always been one of the best ways to build wealth, and that opportunity hasn't been made equal to everyone. But Billionaire's Row takes things to a whole new level and has essentially created an entirely new asset class of luxury real estate. That's partly because there's simply a lot more money to go around. The amount of money being invested around the world has grown massively, creating what some researchers call a giant pool of cash. But alongside this explosion of global wealth, wealth inequality has grown too. A smaller slice of people now control a bigger share of the world's money, and that means the people at the top have bigger and bigger bank accounts. One place to put some of that money? Well, luxury real estate, like the units on Billionaires Row.
And this is historically unprecedented. The amount of very wealthy people with that money coming into the built environment, it mutates the built environment. It mutates architecture.
Matthew Soles has thought a lot about this. In fact, he wrote a whole book on how wealth is reshaping our buildings.
Architecture is under a tremendous amount of pressure to satisfy the investment kind of absorption role. And that's where something like Billionaires Row comes into being.
To really understand why our buildings are changing shape, it's helpful to get to grips with a financial concept called liquidity. Stick with us, and Billionaires Row will start to make a lot more sense.
So all assets have varying degrees of liquidity. You can think of everything that is an asset as existing somewhere on a liquidity spectrum. And at one end of the spectrum is the most liquid asset of all. That is cash. One US dollar bill is exactly the same as every other one US dollar bill. You can hand it off super easily. At the very other end of the liquidity spectrum is real estate, a piece of architecture, often represented as a single-family home with a pitched roof.
Along that spectrum, you have things like artwork and stocks in companies like Tesla or Google.
So my argument is that the logics and practices of finance capitalism is to transform buildings in such a way that they move down the liquidity spectrum to become more like a stock, more like cash.
Enter Billionaires Row.
111 West 57th is an incredibly tall building, but it has a very small number of units in it. All the units are either one entire floor or a unit that spans two floors. Gone is the hallway. You know, you're not going to smell the neighbors cooking. Maybe it's a pleasant smell, maybe it's not, but that's what social life in the city is all about. Gone are all the possibilities for that.
Now, not being able to smell your neighbor's dinner sounds kind of nice, but Matthew says it goes back to this concept of housing sliding closer and closer to something like cash on that liquidity scale.
What does this all mean? This means that you could own a unit in a building like 432 Park and almost never visit it, or maybe never go there, and you can be reasonably assured that it's going to be secure and not problematized by some unpredictable public usage.
With fewer units in the building, you can start to control more of those variables that typically make a house a non-liquid asset. There's no hallway because the elevator opens directly to the apartment. There's no backyard you've got to maintain, no street level windows to protect from vandals on the ground, no leaky roof that you've got to fix.
And you can see this across building types, not only the towers in Billionaires Row, but condominium units in Miami, in Vancouver, in Melbourne. But it's pronounced in something like the Billionaire Row ultra thin towers.
Even with the money and the engineering to make buildings like this possible, you can't just put a super slender skyscraper up wherever you like. Developers need permission to get their projects off the ground, and there are restrictions on how tall they're allowed to build. But here in New York, there are a lot of different loopholes they can use to go beyond the limits.
To try and get my head around all this, I went to go and see Sam Stein. He's a senior policy analyst at the Community Service Society of New York.
I want to ask about incentive zoning. For anyone who hasn't heard of that, what is it? How would you describe it to somebody on the street?
First of all, zoning is the rules about what can be built where, at what height, and what width, and with how much space in between, etc. Incentive zoning says the developer can violate those rules to a certain degree if they do something else that is to the public's benefit.
Just to the west of Billionaires Row, New York City used zoning incentives with the Hudson Yards development to upgrade the subway, create new public parks, and expand the nearby Javits Center. On Billionaires Row, 157 got a tax break from building some affordable housing in the Bronx, but we'll get more into that later. Remember how developers bought up a bunch of air rights to be able to build even taller? Well, the way those rights are obtained typically means the developments are able to move forward without going through the usual public or environmental review process. The Municipal Art Society of New York put together a report called The Accidental Skyline, which looks at how the current New York City zoning regulations have enabled the rise of super tall skyscrapers across the city. This graphic shows the hotspots of unused development rights in 2014 and where new developments popped up a few years later. Billionaires Row sits right in the middle of one of these hotspots here in Midtown Manhattan. 432 Park Avenue was able to rise so high in part because of another loophole in the city's zoning laws. Any floors used for mechanical or structural equipment don't count towards the total height of the building. And at 432 Park, roughly a quarter of its floors are reserved for equipment, not apartments. Now, there are legitimate reasons to have so much space reserved for mechanics. For one, the open-air mechanical floors allow wind to flow through the building in order to reduce any sway. And of course, you need space to store the heating, air conditioning, and elevator motors. But there's an ongoing debate about whether developers are exploiting the rule in order to build further into the sky. Is this great architecture or capitalist ambition? Can those be the same thing? Is that the very essence of New York?
For all the effort, money, and planning that's gone into these buildings, it struck me just how many of the units seem empty. But once I started to look into it, it actually made a lot more sense. And it turns out there's a couple of different reasons for it. They're either unsold or simply unoccupied.
In fact, there are quite a few Billionaires Row properties still on the market. An analysis by Sirhan found that nearly half the units in seven of the buildings were unsold in August. That's $6.7 billion worth of condos still on the market without a buyer. That might be because what was initially unique about 157, the Central Park views, floor-to-ceiling windows, and units sprawling an entire floor, was quickly replicated by the other super talls that popped up. Now, if you're in the market for an ultra-luxury apartment in Manhattan, you have a lot more options.
Well, there's a lot being built. Gloss of 157 sort of it depreciates every year that new projects come through and there's another, you know, it building to live in.
For years, the luxury real estate market in New York City had more supply than demand. But that's starting to change. By September 2021, Manhattan hit record high sales of luxury properties.
But what kind of intrigues me more is the empty units. They've been built, they've been sold, but nobody lives there, at least not all the time. They're second, third, fourth homes, or simply just a place to store wealth.
Now, the idea of a secondary residence isn't new. The French term pied-à-terre, meaning foot to ground, was coined in the 19th century to describe a temporary secondary residence. Today, that's come to represent second homes, usually apartments, in cities away from the owner's primary residence. Every few years, the city of New York does this big housing and vacancy survey. In 2017, they found there were 75,000 pied-à-terre properties across the city. That's up from 55,000 in 2014. In the two zip codes where most Billionaires Row properties are located, roughly half of the single-family homes and condos aren't occupied by their owners. In the rest of the city, the owner occupancy rate is closer to 75%. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that all these units are sitting empty. They could be rented out by their owners who live elsewhere. But none of the Billionaires Row developers would share their occupancy rates with us, and this data gives us a glimpse into how the area around Billionaires Row compares with the rest of the city.
Of course, there's more to owning a property here on Billionaires Row than simply having a place to stay on your trips to New York. You can also score a pretty hefty tax break. That's partly because of the way condominiums are valued here in New York. You'd think the value of a property on Billionaires Row is the price you can sell it for, right? Well, no, this is New York City, and there's a tangled mess of laws to make things complicated.
Here, condos are taxed as if they're a rental apartment building. But the problem is, no one's really renting a $100 million apartment, so there's no benchmark for what the rental value would even be. $10,000 a month, $100,000 a month, there's no precedent for something like that. So what ends up happening is the Billionaire's Row condo is taxed the same as a unit that's worth a fraction of the cost. But that's not all. Ultra luxury can also add on another massive tax break through something called the 421A exemption. Now, we know that talking about the US tax code is not why you clicked on this video, but as boring as it sounds, it's actually a really big part of the appeal of Billionaire's Row. The 421A tax break was originally introduced in New York in the 1970s as a way to encourage developers to build residential housing. That's because the city was concerned about people living for the suburbs. Now, the rules have changed a lot over the years. Today, it's been rebranded as the Affordable Housing New York program. Essentially, developers can get up to 100% of their property taxes erased for a set number of years if a fifth of their development is classified as affordable housing. But despite none of the units in 157 being anywhere near affordable to a non-billionaire, it still benefits from this tax break.
And so if you can defer most, if not all, of the monthly real estate taxes to the developer and then also pass that on to the owners, then the buyers would just jump on these options left and right.
The New York City Independent Budget Office actually did a deep dive into 157's use of the 421A exemption. In order to qualify for it, the developers built 66 units of affordable housing in the Bronx, miles away from Billionaire's Row. The IBO estimated that exemption will cost the city $65.6 million in property tax revenue over 10 years. Still, it found the way the state of New York values its condos provided an even greater tax break to 157's owners than the affordable housing exemption. Extel, the developer behind 157, didn't respond to our request for comment about the IBO report. These tax discrepancies don't just happen on Billionaire's Row. Bloomberg found that one $2.1 million condo in Brooklyn came with a tax bill of just $157. Meanwhile, a condo in the Bronx worth roughly a tenth of that paid nearly $4,000.
The 421A tax abatement cost the city $1.7 billion in the last fiscal year. That's $1.7 billion we could be putting into the development of new, genuinely affordable housing. But instead, it subsidizes mostly luxury housing. So everybody else picks up the slack in terms of the increased tax burden.
Listen, you can argue about capitalism all you want. It's the way of the earth, right? Smart people end up being incentivized to make money and their lifestyle increases and they spend tons of money. And that money being spent is then taxed in a lot of different ways. You're not just paying real estate taxes, you're paying income tax, you're paying dividend tax, you got capital gains tax, you've got sales tax. I think I'm taxed if I go outside and take a left, right? I take a lot of rights just so I don't get taxed. There's a lot of taxes here. And so, you know, all of that tax income pays for a lot of the services that we want and have in the city.
Even though a lot of its units are sitting empty, Billionaire's Row isn't completely dead. And it kind of reminds me of this term in Matthew's book called zombie urbanism. It's used to describe a place that has a lot of housing units that are sold but aren't lived in. It's not quite dead, but also not fully alive either.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Now, zombie urbanism isn't unique to Midtown Manhattan. In Paris, second homes are on the rise, and in a handful of its districts, a quarter of the homes are sitting empty. Some of the most expensive neighbourhoods over in London are eerily quiet at night, as many of the properties are second residences. In Melbourne, experts warned an entire district in a prime location could become a suburb of ghost towers due to unused property. And over in Toronto and Vancouver, tens of thousands of apartments sit vacant most of the year.
I would say these buildings radically matter to everybody. So the kind of system that produces those towers in Billionaire's Row is the very same system that produces slums, homelessness, and affordability crises.
So, where does New York go from here? The city's in an affordable housing crisis, and it's not like these luxury empty apartments are going to be used to house people who really need a place to live.
I think you'll see more people buying apartments for $50, $60, $70, $80, $100 million in 10 years than you'll ever see before, which obviously means that there's going to be a very, very, very noticeable wealth gap in the world as the wealthier get wealthy and the poor get poor. And so who always gets screwed in all of these kind of global financial shifts are the middle class, and that's the people who really do the work. They get taxed the most because they pay strictly off of income. And where do you go, right? Where do you go?
Are susceptible to increases in rent that are practically, for all intents and purposes, an eviction. And I think it's very important that we take a moment to underline that evictions are violence.
The people here are protesting the 421A abatement, and they're angry.
Across New York, there have been calls to rethink the city's zoning policies and how condos are taxed. Paris, Vancouver and Singapore, and soon to be Toronto, all have some form of tax on vacant apartments.
Demonstrators here in Berlin have had enough. Some of their demands include a nationwide rent freeze and the construction of new social and affordable housing.
In Berlin and Barcelona, the government threatened to seize empty buildings and turn them into affordable housing. In 2019, New York state lawmakers proposed an annual recurring tax on second homes valued at more than $5 million, but it was derailed under intense lobbying from real estate groups. Instead, lawmakers embraced a one-time fee on the sale of multi-million dollar homes. None of the developers on Billionaires Row would respond to our repeated requests for comments on the issues raised in this video.
I hope that in 10 years' time, we look back at Billionaires Row as a phenomenal mistake and a dozen missed opportunities. And the most important thing that I hope comes out of Billionaires Row is that the city changes the way that it taxes property, changes the way that it does incentive zoning to actually get the most and a fair distribution of payments.
Billionaires Row shows us once again what the architecture and construction sectors are capable of. It reminds us of their ability to continually evolve and respond to the shifting demands of our economies and societies. Today, these towers stand alongside icons of the skyline and present a kind of history of engineering progress. The rise of 157 set off a super tall boom across New York City that's still not over.
The towers, the skinny pencil towers on Billionaires Row, are the most dramatic manifestation of this new world we live in. They are architecture as spatio-financial form, not as shelter or cultural manifestation.
So I don't have a problem with tall buildings. I love tall buildings. I don't have a problem with new construction. We need more new construction of various kinds. But for that to be the future of our city suggests to me that we've given up on the ideals of the city in the first place.
But as long as human civilization has been around, it's all about what you have and how much you have. And that is what helps civilizations rise, and it's what causes them to fall.
There's a saying that we shape our buildings, and then afterwards, those buildings, they shape us. And for me, that's incredibly true of New York City. The city is synonymous with the skyscraper. It's been shaped by those buildings. They each rose as a product of the events in the city at that time, and now they shape the city's future. We had it with the Empire State and the Chrysler Building rising at the very end of the boom years. We had it again with the original World Trade Center rising in the 1970s and standing through the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. We had it with the rebuilding of the World Trade Center in the wake of 9/11 as the city tried to work out what it wanted to replace those iconic buildings with. And now we've got it with Billionaires Row. Those super slender skyscrapers have risen as a product of demand loopholes, the desire for billionaires to get a view of Central Park, and the city's zoning and planning regulations. Whether you like it or not, whether they're occupied or not, whether they're casting a shadow or not, they are now part of the city's story. They are part of the fabric of New York. Until that next chapter comes along.
One thing's for sure, I want to be here to cover it because I've fallen in love with this place. As always, guys, if you enjoyed this video and you want to get more from the Definitive Video Channel for Construction, you know what to do.